two feelings have been noticed. One is of being alone, and the other is that relationships with friends who are not working at or interested in what we are studying here are sometimes strained. Are these feelings to be expected, and will they eventually go? Yes, is the reply to all of that. It can be avoided. The sensation of being alone and the straining of relations. When you start to work at something other than the herd is working at, you necessarily begin to feel alone, because inside your brain you have certain ideas. You've been brought up in relationship with other beings. These number of beings we can have in the relation is two, and your relation with them has been contingent. It has been the product of stimulation at the physical level through the five senses. You have seen people, heard them, sometimes smelled them, occasionally tasted and touched them. But all of that is contingent in its nature. That's the kind of relation you see where a lot of puppies or kittens are lying on top of each other in comfort. And to a large extent, human beings do this on each other in large groups, or even in small groups in families. They lean upon each other's physical presence for their stimulation. The result is that the consciousness of A depends upon stimulation from B, and the consciousness of B depends on stimulation from A. Now, as long as that relation is the focal center of consciousness, then A and B will feel fairly secure as long as there is some kind of relation. Even if the relation consists in a continuous 24-hour round-the-clock fight. As long as it is a relation. We sometimes find in the Sunday papers ladies in court saying, "My husband no longer loves me." The beat says, "How do you know?" And she replies, "He stopped beating me." Now, she would rather be beaten than have no relation at all. Hence these remarkable marriages that go and survive perhaps 30 years of exchanges of blows. They are relations at the contingent level, and that relation is felt as at least something instead of nothing. So for all people who are brought up on contingent relation, there's a general movement of energy to the perimeter of the being, and wherever the stimulus is on the perimeter, towards that they tend to go. In fact, if you get a person who's had no training at all and tell him to stay home for one night and not see anybody at all, he will find himself physically incapable of doing it. As soon as the external stimuli from other beings is removed, he discovers that the energy which in him habitually goes to the perimeter of his being keeps running out looking for the stimulus, whereby it knows itself to exist. So that when there is no stimulus from other people, it begins to doubt its own existence. It then becomes very depressed and will rush out looking for contact with other people, even people it doesn't like, as long as it gets the contact. Now, as soon as a person starts work to understand themselves and starts introverting energy, turning energy inwards, to meditate upon their own nature, then a backflow of energy starts. And as soon as this backflow becomes established, there is a movement of integration going on to bring the person into center, so that all the different parts of the being are gradually being brought into unity. And this state of unity is what we mean by alone, which, if you remember, is all one. Integration is all oneness, and all oneness is aloneness. So as we're moving towards integration, internally we're moving towards an experience of aloneness. In the act of turning these energies in, we are going out of relation with people on the outside for the time being. And this out of relatedness on the outside is generally felt by other people. They can feel that we are somehow becoming different. They don't know what we are trying to do, and they never will know unless they start to do it themselves. So as our inner introversion in discovering ourselves proceeds, and we become more all one, more integrated, we are becoming more alone, and thereby less and less dependent on the contingent relation, and therefore less and less seeking that contingent relation to bear witness to ourselves that we exist. And simply because the individual being is within a field of energy, then there is no real separation between the two beings. So the introversion of the one being is becoming unified or alone or one, is felt by other beings as something strange, something they don't know anything about. So they feel that when they strike against you, the reaction from you isn't what it used to be. Things ain't what they used to be. Naturally, they would try to return you into the state of reaction that they knew before. If they succeed, of course, you've lost your purpose, and you will go back into that contingent relation. And ultimately you will have to start again, because nobody can stay in a continuous relation with other beings permanently. It's only a relation for a time in order to let you get some sort of substantial response going inside yourself in the stimulus situation. So all oneness, aloneness is bound to arise as you begin to work on yourself. And strained relation feeling is also bound to arise. This cannot be avoided. And if we consider what this strain means as opposed to stress, stress is when you drive things together, strain is when they are flying apart. If we look at the field and see the unity of two beings in contingent relation, it can only be a function of the field which is holding them together. But it's holding them in relation in order that they can be mutually stimulated and thereby informed. And as they become progressively more and more informed about the nature of their own being, so the need for the contingent relation becomes less and less. Now when this contingent relation is being cut down, if the person who has initiated the introversion of energies and who is now feeling alone begins to wonder about it and wonder whether it's doing the right thing, it will feel tempted to go back into contingent relation, which is another way of talking about the prodigal going down twice instead of once. But if it accepts the fact that aloneness is an essential of one's inner development and ultimately of one's peace of mind, one's happiness, one's power, one's efficiency in relations, then one accepts the state of aloneness, and instead of looking for the contingent relation, we penetrate to the centre of our being and feel the field between ourselves and other beings. Now if we feel very carefully, then we can conquer this strain feeling by knowing through feeling what these other beings are requiring. We can actually go into relation with people who are in a real sense far below our own integration level, and we can go into relation with them so that they will never suspect the difference. We can work at their level while they cannot work at our level, and this requires an increase of sensitivity. When this sensitivity increase occurs, then you feel the whole field, which includes all the beings in the contingent relation. Your consciousness is then identified with the field and feels these vehicles as belonging to it. And it can then conduct the relation at another level. Instead of the relation of the contingent clash of physical bodies in disagreements, it can feel what is needed in the development of each being and thus lead the other beings through their feeling into the kind of contingent relationship which will best help their informative process, their self-development. Shortly, that is an answer to the question. We must necessarily become alone as we become progressively moving towards being all one, that is, towards integration. In the act of doing so, because other people are not doing it, therefore there will be an initial feeling of strain, of separation. But after a time we know that this feeling of strain must cease when the integrating person becomes aware of the field of the relation, because then the integrated person can relate at any level lower than itself and remove the feeling of strain. So we can say that those feelings will eventually go. When we get this all-oneness here, we have only got unity. We haven't got non-duality. And remember the difference. In the monistic analysis, you always have circumscription and a sense of oneness. But when you have integrated and gained your unity of mind, integrated your ideas, then you can afford to let go of it, because you're quite certain that it exists and you can become conscious of the field. And the field is non-dual. Remember, we don't call the field one because it's infinite. We call it not two. This feeling then includes the organisms of the other beings with whom we are in relation. As we do it, we will find that we have, in the fact of the field consciousness, a non-dual awareness of the processes going on inside the beings with whom we are in continued relation. So we'll climb up beyond the aloneness, because we'll climb beyond the all-oneness, beyond the concept of integration, into the field which is infinite, and our awareness then will be sharpened. And instead of becoming vague, as people think it will, who have not experienced it, it becomes very, very sharp and understands all the relations going on in the other beings with whom it comes into contact. It means that you can actually feel in other beings, when your field's conscious, what those beings are doing, what they are thinking, what they are feeling, what they are projecting, and it becomes possible, if you so wish, from the field level, to determine the course of action of any other being. But in determining that course, you have to remember that that other being is still one of your beings, because you are the field which has precipitated those bodies. Now, there's another question here. Is there any way in which one can help oneself to remember past events and happenings? Well, there are two ways of doing this. One you all know under the name of Pelmanism, which is simply a commercialized form of the association of ideas, and is the least efficient. And the other one is by increasing field consciousness. Let's look at the method of association of ideas. We have association law based on similars. Insofar as things are similar, they resonate together, just like similar notes on different musical instruments will resonate. If we put two dozen violins around the walls and we just get one violin and they're all tuned to the same notes and we just bow A on one, all the A's on the other violins will resonate. They will sing out quite audibly, although we've not touched them. And the reason is quite simple. The strings are already in a state of vibration like this, at a definite frequency, because there is no matter that is absolutely static. So each string is tuned, is in a certain tension, and is vibrating at a very, very low intensity, but at a definite fixed frequency already. And when we strike that same note on another baron loudly, then the impulses go through the air and impinge on that other string, and thus augment the emotions of the string, and it sings out, it resonates. So the fundamental law governing all association is similarity. Now the simile tells you that it is from the seed, from the same source. If things have not got the same source, then this resonance could not occur. That it occurs shows an identical substantial origin for this sounding. Now similarity can be of space, of time, of form, and we can construct the laws of association from this fact. When we see a certain form, suppose I draw a triangle, and you look at it, and then I draw another one, the second one arrives on a mind already resonating in the form triangular. So the threshold of reaction in the brain has already been crossed by the initial stimulus. So that when the new stimulus comes, it doesn't have to overcome so much substantial brain inertia. Already the mind is vibrating it as a triangle. So when the new stimulus comes, very little energy is needed to bring this triangle back. Now, when we take a substance that's never had a form in it at all, and this substance is purely conceptual, it doesn't really exist, it's a conceptual limit, then it has a colossal amount of mass inertia to overcome. And we experience this as effort. So if I try to see a perfectly new form for the first time, I have to concentrate energy. And this concentration of energy is the evidence to me that I haven't seen it before. So the first time I see a triangle, this substance of my being responds very, very badly, very, very dimly I can see it. Try to teach a child a perfectly new operation in elementary arithmetic and you will discover what we're talking about. The mind does not respond. Let me give you a little example. If we take two glass containers like this with exactly the same cubic capacity, and we fill them up with water, and then say to a child, which one has got the most water in? It says the tall one. If we now empty the other one, and then pour all the water out of the tall one into this other one, and say, did all the water go out of the tall one into the square one here? The child says yes. And then we say, right, we'll pour it all back now. We pour it back. Did it go into the tall one? Yes. We now pour water into this lower tank to the same amount, and then say to the child, now which has got the most water in? And the child says, the tall one. Now this breaks educationalists' hearts, but it happens to be true, because there's an unconscious idea in the mind of the child that tallness is a sign of greater quantity. Because being a baby and its parents being tall, it has an unconscious sense that tallness means importance. And importance is the same thing as value to the child, stress of will. So the tall one must contain more water than the other one. Now, this is a typical example of the mass inertia of the substance. So the first time I tried to perceive a triangle, It cost me a lot of energy to keep my mind on it. And this terrific amount of energy that I need is the basis of my belief that I haven't seen it before. Now, after a time, I present it with another triangle, and already a little bit of the mass inertia has been overcome, and there is already a circulation of nervous energy going around the mind like this, same triangle all the time. And although through the lapse of time from the previous stimulus, it has started to lose something of its intensity because of the substance absorption of it, yet when the new triangle is presented, it goes up very much quicker. Now, if I keep piling this triangular stimulus in, eventually it will stay in my mind without effort. And I will then say, I know about triangles without effort. So, when we are considering form, we can see that if we have seen any form once and we represent it, then the initial inertia having been overcome, we require less energy than we did to become aware of it, and we interpret this less energy use as familiarity with the form. So the brain is already vibrating with all the formal stimuli that we've ever experienced, and this is the ground of our other associations, formal similarity. So to help strengthen the memory, we should learn to look at similar forms. If we look at similar forms, we can begin to perceive formal differences where previously they did not appear to us to exist. If we take, say, national types, there are certain kind of men that have long heads. The anthropologists would look at these. That's a long-headed man. And there are some other men with broad heads. Now, if we see these men together, their difference sticks out. If we then see a long-headed man on another occasion, the fact that we've had this diagram presented to us will serve as a reception vibration for the new stimulus. And that initial diagram will actually categorize the incoming stimuli. That means to say that if we get fundamental geometrical forms firmly engraved in the mind, we shall begin to see various kinds of men in terms of geometrical forms, and as geometrical forms are very much fewer than their derivatives, we have a progressively simpler reference frame to work with. And so we can actually control a multitude of apparently diverse forms by reducing them to the nearest geometrical equivalent. That's when we're first learning to paint. One of the first things we learn about, say, portrait painting, is to see the general character of the head, and say, if I look around the room, that from the cheekbone to the chin is triangular, the next one is rectangular, the next one is oval. So, as soon as I see this character of the three faces, it has given me a measuring device, a geometrical, fundamentally simple structure, into which I can proceed to draw whatever it is that subdivides it. And this enables me to relate things by similarity at the geometrical level. Now, the geometrical level is the same level that we refer to when we talk about the field of Platonic ideas. The eternal forms of motion are geometrical. The temporal forms of it, serially presented, are simply geometrical structures overlapped and stressed in a certain way. So if I take two triangles and overlap them, and then stress a particular part of it, and leave the other part unstressed, I find myself with a form which, if I didn't know that it was in fact made of two triangles, I might fail to recognize that it was really a double triangle with a bit cut off the bottom. If I reduce the thing to its fundamental geometry and commit to memory the particular, the temporal individual, in terms of this fundamental geometry, then my memory becomes more and more under control. That will do for the moment for the formal similarity. Now, when we look at space, space is undetermined. It is in between the forms. So when we're talking about association by space, we are not referring to the in-between the forms. We are still referring to forms. And by space, we really mean environment. You see, the environment, the tying aroundness of other forms. So we still look for forms, but now we look for the forms which surround the one that we want to remember. So if I do several triangles and in the middle of them put a cross, the triangles now represent the environing forms for the cross. If I then see this, I can commit it to memory very, very simply, because it's elementary geometry. If I had first of all drawn a perspective of this thing in a slightly different way, you might not have noticed in the process that I was drawing a sacrifice before an Indian village where the teepees are grouped together, still represent four triangles. The cross has now become the cowboy about to be burned alive. The triangles now represent teepees and constitute the background for this gentleman about to be burned. When we start putting the signs and the little decorations on the teepees, all these are distracting factors. We'll put a few stitches in. And babies, when they're drawing, count them to make sure they're all there. All the subsidiary detail progressively overlays the simple geometry and makes the possibility of remembering it more and more difficult. So when we're talking about space, we are talking about environing forms. We're not talking about the space itself, because that is totally undetermined. But within a given environment that we circumscribe for the purpose of remembering, then we set our associated forms up, and the forms that are going to serve as a background, we will recite to ourselves in their fundamental geometry, and then set over against those forms the one we wish to remember. When we come to consider time, we still got to consider form. And we have to consider form in space again. So we're talking about the environing forms presented serially, one after the other. So if I now set the triangles or teepees in a line, and I progressively colour three up and see one, then there'll be an apparent progression of a triangle through space. I colour three up and show one, then I cover that one up, and those two, this one is now exposed. I cover that one up and that, and expose this. I cover those three up and expose this one. Now this gives serial presentation in time. So the association by time, the occurrence in similar times, is very closely related to environing space. Because in fact, when we try to remember times, we always remember times in terms of spaces that we were in and now are not. So all depends on the similarity of form and space. Is simply a shorthand expression of environing forms, and time is simply a shorthand expression for serially presented forms. If we then accustom ourselves to talking to ourselves in terms of space, time and form, we can understand David Hume's definition of causation, which he uses as another mode of association. Causation, for David Hume, means invariable sequence. when the sequence of events that we see is always the same, there arises in the mind a sense of expectancy. So if we see man puts head on railway line, train comes, runs over and head comes off, and the next day another fellow does it, and the next day another fellow does it, gradually there's built up in our mind an idea that head on railway line and passage of train on the same line results in decapitation. Now Hume said that that wasn't necessary, there was no necessity about it at all. It's simply this invariable sequence. Now it's the fundamental of science today that there is no really scientific ground for assuming that that man's head will come off at all. Because by a simple change of vibration in the structure of it, the molecular structure, he might go into another state of resonance so that the train would pass over him and the head remain on. Now this would break our invariable sequence expectancy. And therefore David Hume says really causation should not be considered as the application of a power producing a necessary change in the material world, but only that there is invariable sequence of events and this invariable sequence imposes on us. Repeated banging of fist onto eye results in repeated blackening of eye. But perhaps by a little change of chemistry there might be an immediate recovery of the tissue and the eye would not go black. This would break the sequence and lead us to look for another law. Because of the inertia of our own beings, we tend to look for causes. Now that is a European interpretation of causation, the idea of invariable sequence of time events. Now in Hindu philosophy, causation has another significance, and cause, if you remember, is causus striking. It means striking power. And in Indian philosophy, striking power is striking on itself. There are no things other than power which is swept in, involved itself, and become its own effect. And this, of course, is the basis of magic. And that's a very nice diagram, too. There's a sweeping in of field energies into the centre, and in the process the energies themselves have become the material body. That material body is now the power. So the power which is the cause is the effect. And that is why you get in Indian philosophy this statement that the cause and the effect are the same. Because the cause is the power which involves itself, compacts itself, and when it is compacted sufficiently for a contingent relation to occur, then arises the effect, which is assumed to be other than the cause, but it isn't. It is the cause involved. From the point of view of learning to remember past events, then, the more we study the similarity in all the individual differences, the more we reduce them to fundamentally simple geometrical structures, the more we will impose an order on the content of our minds, so that with all our mind forms reduced to their fundamental geometry, when one form is set up in the mind, all the forms that are of the same geometrical order will resonate. And this causes the emergence in consciousness of all the related forms. Now you know that in Indian philosophy again there is a little device, yantra, a kind of symbol. One of the chief symbols is a triangle. You meditate on that triangle. You don't meditate on the triangle just for fun, but you do it in order to produce order in the mind. If you look upon that triangle and hold it in your mind, it will cause resonance in the mind. We will say that dynamically it will triangulate in the mind, and then wherever there is in fact a triangular structure of whatever kind, it must resonate with that triangle. That means simply to stand and look at that simple triangle and hold it in your mind is an integrating exercise on its own. It imposes on all the particular forms a resonance that will bring them into relation. Now, you've all heard of, and some of you may have been lucky enough to experience, that peculiar state of the alcoholic called DTs. When Dylan Thomas was having his DTs in America just before he died, he saw one mouse and the rest was geometry. And the cause of this was because he was working in the way he composed his poems in the manner we are talking about. But he didn't know this effect could arise, and therefore it frightened him. He used to write his poems by writing on little bits of paper and then putting them on the top of the desk and then looking all over the table to see what ideas were related together. And then he would compress them together to make a poem. In the process of looking across all these various ideas, he was unconsciously using the law of similar form. And so gradually he built up in himself an awareness of fundamental geometry. Now let's just remember that for a moment. He built up an awareness of fundamental geometry, but without knowing it. Now we'll consider another law. If we take any closed system whatever, and we pile energy into it, the energy will go around inside that system and it'll keep going in and in and in as far as it can. It can't go to the dead center, but it will keep piling in until it blocks that form. Now when the form is completely blocked, if more energy comes in, the form must break, and out of it shoots, in the Feuerschreck or ejaculation or whatever you care to call it, out of it shoots the geometry that was piled in to that form, quite suddenly and unexpected. That is what happened to Dylan Thomas. He had been piling in the similar forms and did not know that if you kept on piling them in, they would eventually, suddenly, release primary geometry. And this primary geometry suddenly presented in his mind, in a state of alcoholism, overwhelmed him and terrified him and led to a very early death. If he had known that this fundamental geometry exists and that we are merely particularizations of it, and had gotten used to the idea that our bodies are only geometrical structures slightly distorted through gravitational and other influences, then he wouldn't have been surprised, he would have been delighted, and he would have written another kind of poetry to the kind he did write, probably less interesting in the popular sense. So, when we come to study the way the mind associates ideas, we have the big law of similarity of form, then the law of environment, environing forms, the background, the one we want to remember, and then the serial presentation of them, the time, then this concept of causation as invariable sequence, and then the Indian concept that the effect is simply the cause, that is power, involved and becoming itself its own effect. In this sense, the universe is an effect of power, and that power is itself manifesting effect. And this is why St. Paul said, from the things visible, we know the invisible. If we find a visible form going like this, and we understand precisely what it means, we know that the forces of the field must be going like that in order to keep that form in being. They're actually travelling in that manner. In the same way, if you can see a triangle in your mind, for the time being, you have become identified in your mind with a triangulating motion. So the throwing of the mind substance into the form of the object is what we call perception of the object. That is the mechanical law of association, and that is working from the bottom end, from the stimulus. We will now consider the other one. When we worked from the bottom end, we had to work very, very hard and look for similars in all the forms that we see. And then gradually they will draw together and begin to interpenetrate each other, and finally they will be associated together in the mind. The shorter way, which requires more power of concentration, is to look directly into the geometrical world. And remember the world of Plato and of Parmenides and all philosophers beginning with P is a world of geometry. This one, in a cyclic manner, sections are possible. Universe means one. This whole sun turning, and by synthesis of its term, this motion being the sphere of the universe. The whole sphere is called Sophia. And Sophia, as well, of express this fact. We live in a field of force which is continually geometrizing. All the forces are going round and altering their X manner and living in the whole of space we form. We are inside it. Somewhere inside there there's the solar system and the earth and the little body that's mine. Now all we do is realize this fact, realize, make real. To make it real for us, we have to differentiate in our own consciousness and yet keep the thing tied together in our own consciousness. If we merely differentiate it, consciousness will fly away, we'll see a lot of forms, and we'll see differentiating, we'll go all soggy, falling asleep. One is by seeing too much. So to realize, we must differentiate. We know that this field exists. We know that it's part of what will be initially designed, that things come into us that we didn't know about. In organic states, all these will come in for security. And if we know that destroyed anybody, but it's the very form of a closed zone of the spirit, which is the same as analysis, this. That is the Sophic sphere. Never met. It is the force that makes our bones, our cell body, makes our blood, maintains us, preserves us. It's always working to try to keep existence. It's trying to make eternal and immortal beings. How does mortality arise inside the Sophic sphere? It arises by a part of the Sophic sphere, force, being superstressed by the individual consciousness. As soon as the superstress appears, then contingent relationship is possible between two of them. In that they can crash against each other and they can become profoundly disturbed by the disturbance of the crash, the vibration. And in so doing, they can wish for disintegration. They can actually try to escape from each other by flying to bits. You know the fairy stories about the contest of the magicians, how one tries to escape another by becoming a sparrow and the other one becomes an eagle and chases him. And he keeps changing form all the time. But all the motions inside the Sophic sphere are eternal. And they are making a perfect pattern. This means there is an organically perfect pattern for every being. That pattern has not got to be made by individual effort. It exists. And we are inside it and are stopping it from manifesting through the clash of the contingent relation of the finite physical bodies. So, this way of remembering things, of discovering past events and so on, is to realize that the Sophic sphere exists, and to let go of the individual self and to dare to go out from the physical center of reference and feel the processes going on inside. Now, if you dare to do that, you'll soon find coming into your mind things you haven't thought about for a long time. And very, very often there comes into the mind things not only that you haven't thought about, but that the individuality from which you started never knew. That is to say, you can remember things that don't belong to that individual body. You can remember forms from other bodies. This is the kind of process, actually, that is the true explanation of the performance that Douglas Johnson gave in that TV interview on Lifeline, when he thought he was contacting the spirits of dead people. The real explanation is that this Sufic sphere contains all the forms, eternally, of all the beings that can ever come to be on earth, that ever have been, and that are. So if you become sufficiently sensitive, you can pick up the whole sphere by field consciousness. And then the consciousness which you say is mine is this Sufic one. This is why Christ says, when he says, I, the little finite, if I judge, my judgment is not right. But if I judge from the Father who makes this, or generates this Sufic sphere, then my judgment is right. Because it contains the whole balanced process. So that method of remembering is an increase of sensitivity. Both methods can be used, but the more efficient one, when you get it, is the Sufic sphere identification. Now we'll go on to the next one. In answer to a recent question, part of the reply given was an instruction to open oneself to the reality of the situation. What is meant by this, and how can it be achieved? To open oneself to the reality of the situation. We've already defined what real is. It is differentiation and linkage, tying the thing together. Now, everything that exists, including the biggest fool idea that was ever fabricated, exists. And therefore it partakes of reality. But the whole of reality is what we are referring to when we are talking about opening ourselves to the reality of the situation. Let's draw the Sufic sphere again. Here is a plane in it, and the forces caused by the spin of energies inside here act in a centrifugal manner and produce a gradient of tension, and this tends to cause rotations around the equator. On this equatorial rotation, when experienced at the equator by an identified mind, results in serial time, the circulation of the stars, of the solar system and everything else, takes place within the Sufic sphere by serial presentation, and this can only occur by identification with the finite, and that is travelling. So serial presentation, again, is the level from which we start, and we say, open ourselves to the realities of the situation. Now the reality of the situation is that if a man is identified there, he is super stressed on that point. But he thinks that is the reality of the situation. But it isn't the reality of the situation. It is one tiny little bit of it. The whole situation is the whole universe. So we have to open ourselves to the whole situation instead of being pinned on a particular. If we are pinned on a particular, we say the least we can pin on is one, then we go out of relationship with the others. So if we imagine one point there, one little atom, and we concentrate on it, to the point that we don't know anything other exists,
then we become lost in the formal identification with that atom. And in the act of doing so, we have no concept that other atoms exist in space. And consequently, our concept of reality is too small. It's been reduced down to a particular level. Now, each substantial being, when it is identified, believes itself to be the centre of an infinite field and to be really the only important centre. Everything starts from me and comes back to me. So says every ego-centred being. And it believes that it is being realistic when it conceives its own wants and its governing rule, I want what I want when I want it. Nice tune. And in the process of wanting what it wants when it wants it, and believing that to be the reality of the situation, it is grossly deceiving itself. Now, if it wants to control the situation, it will have to extend its awareness. And as it's extending its awareness, it is becoming aware, bringing into its field of consciousness more and more of other determinants round about. As it becomes aware of other determinants, it is gaining more capacity for adjusting itself and, if necessary, changing its life direction, altering the axis on which it is travelling, and so releasing itself from the particular which it thought was the real. To extend our consciousness to the whole sphere of being, and then to look back at the particular from which we started, in the light of the whole, is really to open ourselves to the situation. And when we do so, it always gives us greater control of the situation, because now we have become aware of other factors which influence it. If we remember that we have such factors in any situation as the threefold division, thinking, feeling and urging, and we ask ourselves always what those three are doing in each of the beings in the situation, we will always find in the act of trying to consider what the people are feeling, that on trying to feel, our consciousness extends. Whereas in trying to think, it contracts. When Christ said, not by thinking can you add 1 inch to your stature, you can see what he meant. He didn't say not by feeling, he said not by thinking. If you think, you contract, you concentrate the mind to make a form. And that doesn't add an inch to your stature, it takes it off. And if you feel, then you extend your awareness out. And in the process, you become aware of more forms that were not so strongly stressed before, but now they're coming into consciousness and they're relevant to the situation. In fact, the whole suffix fear is relevant to the situation. If today businessmen are aware that there is a need on the whole globe for a government to control the circulation of commodities, it's only because they realise if some government doesn't control these high-powered explosives, then the market may literally be blown away. And if that's blown away, they won't have anybody to absorb their commodities or even their automation devices to manufacture them. So that when they are considering the need for a global government, this consideration has arisen from feeling. It didn't arise from thinking. It arose from feeling insecure when the bomb hit Hiroshima. As soon as that bomb fell, then everybody felt identified with the situation. And this feeling spread out their consciousness over the whole globe, and that feeling gave them a bigger awareness of the situation. So the bomb did them a very peculiar service, because it turned them from little private businesses in different countries scattered about suddenly into a global awareness. It is this sudden global awareness that has produced beatnikism and all other phenomena today, and it has to be faced in this sense. Even businessmen today are being opened to the realities of the situation in that sense. There's another question here. During part of last week's talk on the nature of fear, it was said that this fear was felt by the Absolute prior to creation. The Absolute, after looking into the void of itself and seeing nothing, said, "I am alone." This was said to be the origin of the outgoing fear tremulations. How did the Absolute recognize its aloneness, as prior to creation there was no plurality? By the definition of recognize, we must say that the Absolute did not recognize itself at all. We said before that the cog implies gross material existence. Prior to the circulation, closure of the sphere, and the driving in of energy to the point of saturation point, there was no possibility of cognition at all. The great sweep of the Absolute energies through infinite space as it went through did not recognize itself at all. It felt itself immediately as it traversed space. And in feeling this, it felt that the intersections, the possibility of using each intersection of the forces as a center. But it did not come to the down to the level of cognition until it had used those centers as centers of precipitation, as seeds upon which to condense powers. So shortly, the Absolute did not recognize at all. But it felt immediately, without mediation, its own tremulations. But we don't want to equate our interpretation of fear with the experience of the Absolute of the same feeling. Our experience of fear is caused by contingent relation. The child, when it is smacked on being born, or when it is squeezed pelvically on being born, experiences pain. This pain is a superset, it is excessive. In utero, prior to birth, the child is cushioned off and has no such experience of the contingent clash, so that its prenatal experience is not of the same order. On being born, its fears are grossly exaggerated by the fact of having a gross body. The stimulation is of a very coarse order. And we tend to look at these gross stimuli and think that that is the meaning of the word fear. But the fear of the Absolute is considerably finer than the feeling we get if somebody taps us on the head with a hammer. When the child is in utero, before it's born, the field of the mother is continuously modulating the motions in the developing child. If the mother's feelings change, the feelings of the child change. This bondage is not completely broken for a considerable time after birth, and in what we call the mother fixation state, it isn't broken at all. But where it exists, if the mother feels discomfort or afraid, a light tremulation goes through the child in utero and it experiences fear. It experiences fear when chemical changes occur inside it, which are the necessary concomitants of some of the processes of turning from an egg into a human being, certain critical points. It experiences fear during the process of cell division. because of the simulations produced throughout it. But that fear is not gross material fear of the order that we generally think of. It's a very subtle fear. But even that fear of the child in utero is already a circumscribed fear, and therefore is coarse relative to the absolute fear. The absolute fear is so fine that it's like an anticipation of trouble before trouble can even begin to think about being. And it is that fine anticipation of trouble that is referred to in the New Testament when Christ says there are the quick as opposed to the dead. The quick are those that are so sensitive to this absolute vibration, which is fear in the absolute, called the fear of the Lord, or the Lord's fear, that it can anticipate that in 10 years' time, if it goes in that direction, there'll be trouble. So it doesn't bother to go there. Well, if it does, it only goes there for 9 years and 11 months, and then turns away. So although the absolute does not recognize fear in itself, it feels fear immediately, and that fear is of such a subtle order that it is the ground of the absolute remaining forever free, because it can feel trouble before it has time to get hold of it. So that the closure which could lock it is felt when it's just gone over half a circle. And it immediately feels a tendency to close and whips it back the other way. And thus produces this sinuous line called hazy. So the fear of the Lord, the Lord's fear, is not a bad fear, as we understand gross fear. It is a highly protective fear. It is a fear that allows us to anticipate troubles that most people would never be aware of. Let's take an example from the animal world. Before a big volcanic eruption in South America some years ago, the animals all ran away. And after a couple of days, the birds flew away. And the human beings there, who were very materialistically inclined, thought the animals were being stupid and didn't run away. So that when the trouble came, thousands of human beings were killed. They were killed through insensitivity. The animals who are aware of this field, because they haven't got the colossal egotism of human beings, and therefore do not concentrate on their individuality, and block themselves, had had the message, and they had left. Whereas the supermen, able to think and reason out how stupid animals are, were all killed. So the fear of the Lord itself is the guarantee of our eternal and absolute security, because it's so very, very quick. The last part of this question says, or did the absolute, instead of recognizing its aloneness, say, "Lo, I am not two"? Namely, did it say, "I am a dualist"? The answer is no, it didn't say that either, because in order to say not two, we must first have cognized one. And we must have seen that one, being a closure, won't do. And we must have seen that beyond this oneness of the substance, the monistic view, there is the infinite. And we must assert that the infinite and the gross finite are not two, because the effect is the cause involved. So it does not say, "Lo, I am not two," and it doesn't recognize that it is one. We can't say it is not two until we first learn what one is, and then cross it off. So what the absolute experiences is the immediacy of its own motion. Immediacy means without mediation. That means without these little circles, one of which leads to another. It's this continuous sinuousness of propagation of force that the absolute experiences in and of itself immediately. And you know that the serpent is one of the only symbols that we have in this world of life, and particularly of eternal life. The ancients used the snake as a symbol of eternal life because it sloughs its skin and shows a new snake underneath. And so the oldest image we've got of God is as a serpent. If we look in the Greek alphabet, we'll find two serpents, one like that and one like that. The round one is used for the beginning and middle of words, and the open one, like the English says, is used at the end of words. The round one we call initial and medial S, and the other one we call terminal S. The reason they kept these two was because the round one symbolizes beginning, that is finiting, and continuing, that's in the middle. But the terminal one means squirting back again into freedom. So at the end of a word we write a long S and let it spit out into the void. If there's another word for it to spit out over there, there'll be a quantum jump. The serpent then symbolizes in its openness the sinuous motion of the absolute, and in its closeness the devil or dividing principle. And yet it is not two serpents, because there is no closing force other than the force of the absolute traversing space and folding back on itself, producing zones around which energy appears to circulate. The progression of the absolute is in this sinuous form. Where it folds back over itself, there's a possibility of identifying. During identification, we consider that the energy is only rotating. Now, this is only an appearance. It is not only rotating. This is entirely subjective. When we will to consider it as rotating only, we are finiting and creating ego consciousness. Thus, if we like to think that our own minds are insulated and deliberately exclude other ideas, we are closing ourselves and becoming an initial and medial S. But if we ask ourselves the truth, am I really closed? And listen to the answer will say, no, you can't be really closed, because you can see another being. And the energy from that other being is coming to you from outside. So something is getting into your so-called closed S. For instance, the light from that lamp up there is going into my eye. So I am not closed to the light. If that closed serpent represents myself, then this loose serpent represents the light penetrating into myself. So it is a fiction to pretend that I am a closed system. It is convenient to pretend so when sitting on a seat in a bus, but it isn't true. If then I remember this fact and know that if I heard the rustle of a piece of paper then, that sound coming to me tells me that I'm not a closed system. And that shows us the value of the external sense stimulus. It continuously convicts us of egotism when we think that we are isolated by crashing through the sensorium and imposing itself on consciousness, and thus convincing us that the finite is not really a closed system at all. I think that's dealt with those questions. We'll go on a little bit now to consider something to do with the value of this, and particularly of sound, of music. It is a physical fact, and statistically verified, that if we take a lot of blind men who have good ears, and a lot of deaf men with very good eyes, we will find a marked psychological difference between them. The men who are blind and have good ears have good understanding and compassion and feel for others. But the men who are deaf and have good eyes are shot through with suspicion of the motives of other people. And they are hard and insular. We'll see why this is so. If I am blind but have good ears, I can hear somebody coming from a distance, even round the corners. If I listen very carefully, I can hear things going on outside, most cars going by. But if I am deaf, I've only got my eyes to rely on. I don't know anything is coming until it actually turns the corner and gets into my line of vision. So the amount of fear in a man with good eyes, who is deaf, is very, very much greater than the amount in a man with good ears, who is blind. It is worth thinking about, because it tells us something of the power of music and why music has the power it has. When we look at the visual arts, say painting, sculpture and so on, if we look at the visual arts, say a painting, we get a light, the light shines onto the picture, which is only a surface, and shines into the eye. Should have shown it over there, the angle of incidence and reflection are the same. Shines into the eye. Then all that is coming to that eye is light reflected from a surface. It is essentially a superficial experience. And it falls on the retina, a relatively flat thing there. And it covers the retina with so many light vibrations of different colours. The interpretation of that flat picture can only be superficial. So that in the visual arts we don't get to know very, very much about it. If we had to rely merely on the eye, our understanding of the universe would be very, very little. When a baby is born, it cannot tell by using its eyes how far away things are. It's no idea. A baby will put his hand out to get hold of the moon or of that electric bulb, because before it has had experience of stretching out its hand to coordinate the sense of touch with the visual impression, it has no concept of a third dimension at all. There is no external space for it. But funnily enough, children are tremendously sensitive to sound. And the sound intensities convey information to the child, and the information, instead of bouncing off a surface onto another surface and requiring interpretation, penetrates through the body into the very bones of that child, and it feels the disturbances in the bones. In other words, sound is a depth experience, while sight is a superficial experience. You might have noticed this in relation to TV and sound radio. If you get a good play on sound radio, you will find that you will enjoy it more and have a greater sense of depth and understanding. And if you look at it on the TV, you will actually have less sense of depth than you did on the sound radio. Sound then has power to penetrate very, very deeply. Let's look at the scientific fact. We've known about ultralight for a long time, ultraviolet and the infrared. Lights beyond the level at which we can see, and yet science has not found in them power and destruction like it is found in ultrasound. Ultrasonic investigations have shown that we can destroy people with those frequencies very, very quickly. Whereas the ultraviolet, infrared, haven't got the same destructive power. It'll take so many minutes to get an amount of damage out of the one, and so many seconds to get damage with the other. Along the evolution of ultrasound, we are getting nearer and nearer to the very principle of unity in the universe as a formative force. Sound, when we say sound in wind and limb, we mean healthy. Sound implies a motion the spirit is going round and empowering itself and dividing. This is like a sound diagram. That's like the word sound. Spirit comes in, rotates, empowers itself by penetrating, divides itself, and it goes right to the depths of being. Now, this makes sound tremendously important for our evolution. Music does a very peculiar thing to us that visual imagery on pictures cannot do. Let's have a look at another way. If we take all the visual experiences we have, we say that they are to do with forms, and by forms we are referring to circumscriptions. Every form has limits, defined edges. And when we talk about the rational faculty, we generally mean to say that which deals with the ratio of things as seen. So that geometry of the plane order, the measurement of triangles and so on, as a visual thing, a plane geometry, is superficial. The visual aspects of plane geometry are superficial. So we cannot disturb people with plane geometry as much as we can with sound, because plane geometry goes into visual centres which are very much more restricted and superficial. But when we go into three-dimensional geometry, it cannot be seen by the eye, but it can be felt by the body itself. If we subject the body to sound, the body actually experiences the sound on its perimeter as loud, and in the depth of its being as qualitatively changed and diminished in volume through passing through its own substance. So it actually has a three-dimensional experience within its own substance from the reception of sound that the reception of light being reflected from its surfaces cannot give it. We can see then why sound operates directly on the feeling while sight operates on the intellect. Sound then has the power to put us in contact with the field, the absolute field. And immediately then we see the significance of mantra yoga, which is concerned with sound, as opposed to yantra yoga, which is concerned with visual stimuli. We've seen how easy it is to do a diagram of a triangle and look at it with the eye. We know that if we look at it for some time, that triangle will cause us to see all triangular things we have ever experienced. But it will still be only a visual experience and therefore superficial. But supposing we do another thing, we take sound and we think of a certain note, sequence, like a tune. Now there aren't many people that can hear a tune without feeling something peculiar in the process, and it will throw their minds back to an emotional situation in which they were when they first heard that tune. The power of music to evoke situations is greater than that of sight. Now there's another method of getting things into the organism, by smell and taste. Smell itself, as you know, you breathe the thing inside, certain nerves are vibrating, and the nose is related very, very strongly to the sexual life because of the selective process that you see in the animal world. And therefore, in smelling, there is another kind of very deep penetration which evokes memories very, very quickly, in a way different from that of the visual experience. So if you smell a perfume suddenly, and you haven't smelled that perfume for 25 years, nevertheless, suddenly smelling that perfume has power to conjure up the situation in which you smell that perfume the first time. But as smell depends on particles going into contact inside the nose and so on, it is still particular. it imparts little vibrations to the nerve endings. And although it is deeper than sight, it is not as deep as sound. Now when we look at touch, touch depends entirely on the contact of surfaces. So touch can tell us very, very little about an object, except its resistance and its texture, its humidity, its temperature, and so on. But it does not give us the depth of that being. So it is only the sound that has the power to give us this depth consciousness in our own being. So that when we recite sounds to ourselves, even simple sounds like the vowel O, we have another mode of doing this conjuring of the memory, similar to the socket sphere, but instead of from the visual end, from the true logos end. Remember that logos is the supreme dynamic form which is keeping the sophic sphere in being. And the logos as creative sound penetrates through all depths of being whatever. So if we look at the letter O and only look at it, after a period of time it will conjure up all visual forms related to O, which is the purpose of the yantra, the visual diagram. But if we recite the sound O to ourselves and feel that O, not see it, feel it, then it will conjure up inside us all the words that have a feeling in them, like the feeling that you get when you recite O. And this causes the integration of all the words that have got the sound O. If you then go through your alphabet, spending a period of time on each letter, beginning with the vowels, you will discover that words begin to link together as sound systems. They are resonating with the O, just like the violins on the, hanging on the wall, all resound to the one we pluck. So all the sounds, all the spoken words we have ever heard, begin to resonate when we sound that vowel. And then not merely the resonation within our individual being, which we've already proved is not a closed system, but all O's, wheresoever they may be, this goes right up to the sphere than which you can conceive no larger. So you have an immediate method of meditating on the universal sphere, the sophic sphere, in terms of sound, by simply sounding the vowel O. Now, if you sound the vowel O to yourself, you can either sound it whispered or toned. If you sound it whispered, then what will arise in the mind will not be the same as if you sound it with tone on it, that is, O. If you close your lips and try to pronounce it without opening your lips, you will utter the sound M, which is the meaning of the Om of the Hindus. If when you are sounding Om to yourself, you don't think about it merely as sound externally, but you feel that the whole sphere of the vocal apparatus is now blocked with substance, and that that substance is really energy rotating within the closure within the mouth, then you will feel the relation between yourself as a substantial being and the sophic sphere as the universal substantial being. And the intoning of that word will therefore harmonize you with the sophic sphere and the substantial reality of the whole universe. And that is the fundamental idea behind all prayer, behind all incantation. That when you recite a sound, you are literally conjuring, bringing together, causing to converge on the sound you're uttering, all universal forces that are resonating in the same manner. And they have no choice in the matter. They must come if you do it. So that if you persist You must invoke them. So if we start with a sphere, and we use that sphere all, and we keep it in our mind, feel its meaning, and then we bring into it R and strike it within, we will first circumscribe the whole universe, and then we will bring into it an activating principle symbolized by R, and then we put E, symbolizing the particular that we want to conjure into the middle. If we do this in order, we're doing a proper magical process. And you notice that this is the same as the name of God reversed. That the E-R-U, which is the Jehovah, is now the O-R-E. Because it's an involving of this creative power. When you get comic histories of magic and they tell you to draw something on the floor like a circle, and then to banish people out, when beginners nervously try it and they draw a circle on the floor and get inside it and vanish, it suddenly occurs to them that they haven't drawn a circle over them as well as around them on the floor, and they haven't drawn one in the cellar. So they feel a bit insecure above and below. One magician friend of mine who tried to get out of this by constructing for himself a dodecahedron and standing inside of this thing to do his invocation. But he wasn't quite sure whether plastic was a sufficient insect. And by feeling things and repeating the feeling until the feeling dominates the consciousness completely, then there must necessarily be, at the point of that dominance, that identification with that mountain, the inflow of all universal forms of light order.
This would suggest that listening to something is preferable to reading it. Listening to a lecture of this nature is far superior, no doubt, to
reading it.
To actually reading
far
it.
Far superior, because you know in the first place that the printed word is only second-hand spoken word. Mm. And therefore you've still got to translate the printed word back into sound in your own head. Mm. And in any case, there is something in the tone, tonal delivery of things, that is unrepresentable on the printed page.
Yes.